as a magic system. They're a Cote d'Ivoire band, and the song you're listening to was Zouglou Dance, and just before that was Premier Goo. So as discussed, we have David Austin on the line, and he is in town promoting his newest book, Fear of a Black Nation, Race, Sex, and Security in 60s Montreal. And he'll also be doing a book discussion at a different book list this week, Thursday, August the 8th at 7 p.m. And that's located at 746 Bathurst Street. David, are you online?
I'm here. Hello.
Okay, excellent.
Okay, I can.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Okay, so yes, like I was saying, you have a excellent new book out. It's available in stores right now. There's been wonderful reviews for the book, so congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
So let's get started. The title of the book, Fear of a Black Nation, that kind of reminds me of Fear of a Black Planet, with a reference to the classic hip-hop album by Public Enemy.
Exactly. I mean, the title is partly inspired by, well, it's largely inspired by the title of that classic Public Enemy album, which was very much influential on me when I was a teenager, living in Toronto, actually. I went to high school in Toronto. But the title speaks very much to some of the issues that I raised in the book. I changed the title slightly to Fear of a Black Nation, partly because I kind of look at Montreal in the 1960s as a place where there were these competing forms of nationalism, Quebec nationalism, Canadian nationalism, and black nationalism, all vying for attention. So Fear of a Black Nation as opposed to Planet Work. But I also, to be very frank, changed the title because I didn't want to be sued for copyright infringement. but Nation works very well. In fact, in some ways, works better. Yeah.
You've devoted many years dealing with activism, especially within the black community in Montreal. You had a book prior to this on the intellectual C.L.R. James.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to this particular line of work?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I went to high school in Toronto, but I went to elementary school for a few years in Montreal. So Montreal has been, you know, from a young age, has been a part of my consciousness. But it was here in Toronto at Third World Bookstore in the 1990s and late 80s. Where we would meet and talk and discuss, just not too far from where a different book list is today. And in that bookstore, I discovered a book called Groundings with My Brothers, The Groundings with My Brothers by Walter Rodney, where there are these lectures that were transcribed into chapters of his book, where he talks about the situation in Jamaica, he talks about Rastafari, he talks about African history. But I realized that those lectures, three of them, were delivered in Montreal in 1968, when he was in Montreal for the Congress of Black Writers. So that was my kind of first clue that there was something about Montreal in the 1960s that made it an important place of kind of Caribbean, Black Canadian, and kind of Pan-African Black Power political activity. So when I moved to Montreal back to Montreal to go to school in 1990, I was in many respects kind of trying to trace the roots of that presentation by Walter Rodney and some of the other events that I discovered had taken place in Montreal. The Congress of Black Writers was one of them, but it was also the Sir George Williams affair. And it became very clear that Montreal was not only an important site for black political activity in Canada, but had become an important transnational political site. And that was, and thinking about the title of the book, Fear of a Black Nation, that produced a great deal of fear in the eyes of Canadian state security, that is the RCMP at the time, but is now CSIS, that Montreal was in fact becoming this transnational political site, this site of black power, and they were very, very concerned about it. So much so, actually, that they went as far as saying that if they did not deal with this situation, the actions of these folks, who were not doing anything illegal, they were organizing in the face of Canadian racism, they weren't doing anything illegal, but the Canadian state security felt that if they did not deal with these folks, they represented a serious and one of the most significant threats to Canadian national security. They actually used language like these folks would destroy the Canadian state within a generation.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And the book focuses on, as you mentioned, the 1968 Congress of Black Writers, Activists, and Intellectuals at McGill University, mm-hmm. and the subsequent protests that happened at the Sir George William campus, now Concordia.
That's right.
So this only happened about 30 years ago.
Yeah, not too long ago.
You've done extensive research. You have also information from RCMP dossiers with the surveillance on mm-hmm. those groups. Do you also have first-hand accounts from people who were there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did a number of interviews. In fact, some of the interviews included in the book go back to the early 1990s, mid-1990s, when I, you know, was not necessarily thinking about writing a book at the time, but I used to be working radio, and I thought it was important to begin documenting some of those stories. And so some of those are in the book. There are some people that I interviewed more recently when I was very consciously thinking about writing the book, people like Rocky Jones, Leroy Butcher, who just passed away, as did Rocky Jones. They're both late Rocky Jones and Leroy Butcher, two people that were very actively involved in this period. There are a number of women like Jean Depardieu and Celia Daniel, a number of people who were active during that period, and many of whom are still alive and still around and still quite active in their own ways. And so the book is partially based on interviews, at least that's those interviews very much inform my understanding of that period. But much later, I began to do kind of archival research with these RCMP files. I think I go through government documents to see the response of parliamentarians, including the prime minister and former prime minister, that's Pierre Trudeau, and John Diefenbaker before him, and how they responded to this growing presence in Montreal and other parliamentarians. So there's quite a bit of research that's beyond that goes outside of those oral accounts. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you inherit stories from people who you become very close to. And at a certain point, you have to kind of be able to step back and put it all in a perspective that's kind of your own, in a sense, drawing on the many narratives that you have inherited from people, as well as the research that you have done. So it's a combination of all of those things. There are two chapters that really kind of explore the context in which these events occurred, and particularly looking at the French Quebecers who were involved in their own form of Quebec nationalism. And I talk about how many of the leading figures in Quebec nationalism during that time, writers and thinkers, were profoundly influenced by anti-colonial movements in the African continent. So Quebec's most important, famous writer, Hubert Aquin, a fiction writer, was also working on documentaries for the National Film Board of Canada on African decolonization and travel to Africa. One of the key characters in what is probably his most significant book is a figure from Senegal. In the second episode, La Prochaine Episode, which is his most famous book, as I mentioned, people like Pierre Valliere and most of Quebec's most important poets during that period were profoundly shaped by the thinking of Frantz Fanon and Aimé Césaire. So I kind of use that to kind of think about what that moment meant for French Quebecers who were thinking about nationalism in their own way. And yet, while they're drawing on these thinkers, and while they're drawing on the Black Power movement in the United States and the work of the Black Panther Party and other groups, Black people in Montreal prior to 1968 were basically invisible to them. And then, of course, the Congress of Black Writers happens, and the Sir George Williams affair happens, and these events are covered quite extensively in French newspapers as well as in the English newspapers. So that, in many respects, 1968-69 becomes, those are the years in which the Black presence in Canada via Montreal, largely at that particular moment, becomes acknowledged and recognized. And up until that point, in many respects, Black folks are largely, the term I use drawing on some other writers, is invisible, mm-hmm. meaning that you can't not see Black folks, but they could be seen but unacknowledged.
Definitely this continues on even today, where, you know, this history is completely missing from our discussion as a Canadian population. Even to the point where Stephen Harper in 2009 mentioned that there was no history of colonialism.
Exactly, so, exactly. And yeah, I mean, we're not part of the national narrative, and we're not part of Quebec's national narrative. And in that respect, we still remain largely invisible. There was a moment, though, in 68, 69, and for some years after that, where Black folks made their presence felt in a way in this country that made it impossible to be invisible for that time. So the question becomes, you know, where are we today and how we arrived at this point? And And I think going back to the 1960s and seeing how people organize themselves, black folks organize themselves to bring about change in what was in many respects a hostile context, has something to tell us about, not necessarily we need to repeat what was in the past. You can't reconfigure the past, but says something to us about, what we can do in the here and now.
And you've mentioned in an interview before where you believe multiculturalism plays a role into this. Can you expand on that a bit?
Well, I think that, Canada's multicultural policies in part came about in response to these racial problems that existed in Canada. As large numbers of people from the Caribbean began to arrive here, and then folks coming here from various parts of the African continent, and plus the black population that was here, and then other immigrants, Canada had to figure out where it was going and how it was going to, quote-unquote, handle these peoples. And multiculturalism as a policy, which became a kind of policy of inclusive exclusion or exclusive inclusion, depending on how you look at it, was a way of dealing with that. And I would suggest that, when you look at in terms of that policy, in terms of representing various groups and how they were represented culturally, when you look at how various groups were funded, I would suggest that that somewhat contributed to the depoliticization of many of these groups. So we have groups that came of age in the post-Sir George Williams affair of 1969 in Montreal and across the country. And they came of age, and the community came of age through political action. And what we saw is within, 5, 6, 7 years, many of these groups were, all of these organizations were providing services, or individuals that were involved in these movements were now working for organizations that were providing services. Now, many of these services were much needed, so I don't want to dismiss that. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying what we lost in that exchange was the ability to freely organize in the political sense. And I think we need to revisit that, because many of those organizations are not just in Montreal, across the country, are now ailing, right? And those monies that were once available to community groups are no longer available in large sums. And the need to politically organize, to organize in our communities, whether we call it political or not, has not diminished. And if anything, it's more necessary today than it was 40 years ago. So it's worth rethinking that model in terms of the dependency that many of our organizations have had historically on government funding and what that means, which is not to say we're not entitled to it, but what does it, what is it, what comes with that exchange?
This is a fascinating discussion. We should have more time to delve into further, but you're going to be at Different Blacklist, as I mentioned, this Thursday at 7 p.m., and we look forward to the discussion that you'll be having. You can pick up David Austin's excellent book, Fear of a Black Nation, in stores now.
Thank you so
much for your time.
Take care, then.
Take care. You're hearing is the protest that took place in front of the Sheraton Hotel yesterday, and it was greeting President of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. There was a protest organized against his presence for the first Rwandan Day festival that was held in Toronto, Canada, yesterday afternoon. Previous ones were held in the U.S., London, and Paris. So it was an opportunity for the Rwandese community in Canada to connect with their community members and learn about investment opportunities for their home country. But it was the very presence of Paul Kagame that brought protesters to the event, saying that Canada shouldn't have let in the president of Rwanda inside the country in the first place due to his human rights record. So here is a clip of me speaking with one of the organizers of the protest that was held in front of the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Toronto. I'm here today with Serge, and he is one of the organizers of the protest that is happening today in Toronto. Could you give first a brief introduction of yourself and why you guys organized it today against Paul Kagame?
Thank you so much. Like you say, my name is Serge Ndayizeye. I'm from Rwanda. I actually resident in the United States of America. I am one of the person who organized this event to protest against Paul Kagame. Paul Kagame, it's a criminal. Paul Kagame killing Rwandans, Congolese, and then he keep continue to kill us here and abroad. We protest today. We want to just send a message to the Canadian government that they make a huge mistake to welcome Paul Kagame here to Canada. It's been about 7 years Kagame was not welcome to Canada. A sudden Kagame just landed here to Canada. We're wondering now how Canadian government changed the mind to give a visa to Paul Kagame. Paul Kagame, he's a criminal, like I say. He started in 1990. He invaded Rwanda, and then he fight over 4 years. A sudden, he shoot the premier president of Habyarimana, which crushed the genocide in 1994. Over the million people were slain in Rwanda. Kagame, he's responsible for starting the war and then the genocide. So the reason I'm here today is to advocate the voice. So the Canadian government will never do things like that. Canadian government teach freedom of speech, teaching the human rights issue. So we are very sad. We're now happy how Canadian government would accept a criminal who has a blood in his hand. So the event for today, mainly is not like Rwanda Day. It's called Kagame Day. If Kagame wanna just get a more majority in the diaspora, Kagame has lost on the ground in Rwanda. People are not happy with Kagame governments. People are free the country every day. So Kagame now try to get more support in the diaspora. That's why he started these things in 3 years ago. He go over like he tried to do over 3 Rwanda Day in 1 year. Can you imagine a president who spend 3 trips in every year worldwide, spend more money, over the $2 million, buy a people ticket from Rwanda, over 500 people have to come with him, try to sing the song about he's the powerful man, so acting those people living in diaspora. No, those people from Rwanda, he buy the ticket, he came with them. Another thing Kagame say, he try to tell the people who does business in Rwanda to come abroad, teaching the Western country how economic and development is going well in Rwanda. It's false information. Kagame, he's using those people who does business to come to abroad, not by themselves because they want to do it, but because Kagame tell them what he want to do. So it's bad going that, because the country is very bad, corrupts. The country is bad managing by system, Kagame system. So today I'm protest with all of that. I don't know if Kagame is still in power, the country is going to be slow like it happened in 1994.
And you are a member of a political organization. Paul Kagame has cut down political opponents. He's jailed them. Some have speculated that even assassination has happened. Can you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, sure. What I'm going to say here, I'm surprised that the worldwide knows that. Kagame is a criminal. Start 1994, he killed 4 presidents. He killed president of Habyarimana. He killed president of Burundi. He killed president of Congo. So Kagame is a free man, and the whole worldwide knows that he's a criminal. So let me explain to you how Kagame has been operated. Kagame would pay money to fire one single human being just to kill himself. I don't know if you heard the story of his ex-general, General Kayumba Nyamwasa, who resided in South Africa. When we heard on the radio how Kagame spied people was dealing, go kill one human being for pay $500 million just to kill one human being. Imagine that money can pay for tuition at school. The money can help the poor people to get clean water, to get a better education in the country. But Kagame does not care for us. Kagame care himself and try to see how he can stay on the power.
What's the atmosphere like in Rwanda in terms of political organizations in opposition to Kagame?
There's no opposition in Rwanda. The opposition who's in Rwanda, they were under Kagame system. They tried to say there's a political space. There's no such thing as political space. For example, this month they just finished election for the people who in the Senate or the Congress. All those people was voted by RPF. RPF won over 85%. Imagine a country with one political party who won over seat 85% in Senate. It's not making any sense. It's not political party. So Kagame, when he does, he go under political party. He make a confusion those political party, and then he buy people who's in political party, they work under system, Kagame system, just to help him to stay in power. Right now we're talking about Kagame supposed to step down in 2017, but Kagame mind now is trying to plan how can stay on the power longer, change the constitution. That's what we're talking about right now. He don't wanna step down, so he's a dictator right now. He built on dictatorship regime.
Why do you think international media has kind of looked away from these political aggression that's been happening in the country?
That's the false information. This is something I believe Western countries, they feel guilty because they never helped Rwanda to stop a genocide. And the Kagame used that as one of the tools to intimidate it. Western country. Anytime Western country try to say something to Kagame, Kagame say, "Where were you in 1994? That's the only answer Kagame give to Western country. Anytime the human rights report is out, Kagame will say, "Where are you in 1994? Including like Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, the two men who is powerful in the world right now today, they will run the Kagame system, they work for him, because they know they were part of what happened in Rwanda. Kagame now invest in Congo. It's been over 17 years since the war in Congo. There's 8 million Congolese people who've been died. 2 million women have been raped, but nobody talk about. Because when it's in the country, they've been knows exactly that. But Kagame have so many powerful men who help him just to cover the story. So that is going on right now.
Why is it important for you to have a multi-ethnic group representing the opposition?
Yeah, it makes sense now. Now we are Hutu and Tutsi. Kagame used to say, "Oh, those people who protest, they were genocidal. They did the genocide in Rwanda, now they fled to a country. It's no longer a story to tell. We are Hutu and Tutsi, get together. Because we sick tired this dictatorship of Paul Kagame. Kagame killed Hutu, same time he killed the Tutsi. Kagame will kill the poor, he will kill the rich. Kagame does not care for anyone in Rwanda."
Today's fifth annual day for Rwanda is in part due to economic development for the country. And a lot of people have been saying that it's really only for the elite, for the rich to get richer, and it doesn't really affect the regular people that live in Rwanda.
That's true. When you look at how Rwanda has been developing in the last 18 years, Kagame tried to call himself like a visionary leader that he developed the country. But we have to look at how Kagame got to the development, where he got the resources, where he got the money to build the country. When you're looking at the economics of Rwanda today, Rwanda does not have any mineral. But Rwanda is the first country in Africa who has the business in mineral. You have to wonder where they come the mineral. The mineral is coming to neighborhood country. Congo is a rich country. Rwanda invented Congo. We have a Rwanda soldier in Congo today. M23, the rebel group, is from Rwanda. Those mineral will come to Rwanda from Congo, and then the Western country going to come buy from Rwanda. So I know economic of Rwanda, it must go high because there's a mineral market in Rwanda, which has come from Congo. So Kagame used as a tool, look at what I did. I took this country in the low rate, now the country is high rate. I don't buy it because it's fabricated. And we know also the Minister for Finance, he fabricated the numbers to show the Western country. Like, today now Rwanda is in 8% economic growth. It's not true. Rwanda still live under poverty level. Rwanda starving every day. Rwanda student, they cannot afford it to eat and to go to school. So the rich in Rwanda, the poor in Rwanda. Economic of Rwanda today, it's among the rich who's in the political party for RPF. RPF own over 95% of the economic of Rwanda because they are a political party, they are military, and then they do whatever they want. So the economic development you see in Rwanda does not belong to anyone. It belongs to RPF groups, which is Kagame, he's the boss, and among his clique around.
And can you describe how this particular protest came to be?
Protest was organized by the political party who live in exile. I'm speaking on behalf right now for Rwanda National Congress. We've been there for 3 years, and there's also Amahoro People Congress. They've been an opposition group since 1997. There's also FDU Hingi, and then also civil society. So when you heard Kagame is coming to Canada, we say, no, we're not going to sit down. Let's get together. Let's do something. Let's speak out. Let our voice be heard by the Canadian government, by Canadian authority, because we know Canadian, they made a big mistake to offer Kagame a visa. So what we're going to say today, we're going to tell the truth, what happened to Rwanda. Tell the truth, what we want for Rwanda. Educate the people to know that you're not going to stop a genocide worldwide. When many who started genocide in Rwanda, he's still free today. We want Kagame to go to CPE. We want a worldwide to arrest Kagame and the first justice.
Are you guys active with social media?
Yes, we act on social media by myself. I'm a host of radio. It's one of radio to mobilize more Rwandans to wake up, to speak out. Rwanda's been intimidated because they can't speak out themselves. Today, I'm speaking on behalf of Rwandans who's in the country. When they saw me, they will say, that's a humble. You're a humble man because you stand up. you speak out because we need to be free. So we have our website, like rwandanationalcongress.co.uk. We have like a maholocongress.com. We have a Facebook, a Twitter. We use social media to educate people all over the world.
Thank you so much for your time today, Serge. And any final words?
We're going to be here all day. We want you, the whole world, to know that. We ask you on behalf on the radio to speak out the truth. We want the Canadian government people to know Kagame is a criminal. He needs to be brought to justice. We ask justice. We beg justice. There's nothing else we need. We don't need the money. We don't need the water. We need the justice for all human equal.